sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
Let me tell you what's wrong with the productivity metric, because I fought this battle, and this is maybe why I don't have hair and you still do. Two problems. You got the nibbled to death by ducks problem, and you got the golf course problem. And the nibbled to death by ducks problem is this. When you look at, you know, the 80-20 rule, in any business, you can find 80% in the factory, 80% of your problems are 20%. We know that. But not in sales. If you look at the latest Salesforce time utilization data, salespeople have a bunch of 9% problems. Planning is 9% of their time. Coaching is 9% of their time. Finding content is 9% of their time. You know, presentation development is 9% of their time. So it's like, you're going after a bunch of 9%ers, and those break down into a lot of little things. And so finding the easy button is hard.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. Now, that was Stephen DiOrio. Stephen's the executive director at the Revenue Enablement Institute. And I connected with Stephen a few months ago after he sent me an article he'd written for Forbes about the new economics of field sales. And I thought it'd be fun to bring him onto the show to talk about field sales. So we don't talk about that very often, especially in light of what's happened over the past year. Now, the pandemic has been an eye-opener for many business leaders, and as Steve and I talk about, many are doubling down on changes they made during the transition to remote selling in order to try to increase client access and coverage while retaining the cost savings that they got from remote selling. And I think perhaps all that maybe is part of sales bosses fantasizing that they can indulge in, you know, how to sell more for less money, which I'm not sure that really works. But anyway, Steve and I dig into this notion of whether it's realistic to assume that remote selling can be a cure-all and drive revenue growth and improve performance and improve productivity, which leads us to another of my favorite topics, sales productivity. Now, this is a really interesting conversation about a topic that is front and center for many sales bosses. I have to admit that I personally have a fair amount of skepticism about some of this newfound enthusiasm that leaders appear to have for remote selling. First of all, in my book, remote selling is nothing new. Sellers have been doing it since Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. And I think, unfortunately, in most cases, this enthusiasm for remote selling is being used as a pretext by companies to continue to underinvest in developing the talents of their sellers, which, again, I don't think is a recipe for success. But anyway, take a listen to this conversation and let me know what you think. Now, before we get to Stephen, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd certainly appreciate it if you could also give us your feedback about how we're doing in the form of a review. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it. Stephen DiOrio. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So where have you been sheltering during this pandemic?
So I'm sheltering in Connecticut, adjacent to New York City. Since I write a lot, my life hasn't changed too much, but I haven't been out in front of clients like most people, which is a problem.
You say it's a problem. Why is it a problem?
Well, you know, I'm extroverted. Like most salespeople, you know, this whole EQ aspect of Zoom meetings is really the scientists at Wharton talk a lot about that, you know, people who are in sales naturally gravitate to be people. And even though you can be effective remotely, obviously, there's a fulfilling aspect of it that is missing. And that's one of the big rubs, really, right now.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I would imagine. So, and I think this is something that we've talked about on this show and other places, is that you know, maybe we've seen this sort of false, I don't know, the early successes that were achieved during shutdown and so on are maybe sort of a false positive, and that now we're confronting sort of, especially with the potential and the very real potential of a second wave of and a surge in COVID infections, COVID-19 infections, the possibility of secondary shutdowns, is that, you know, perhaps things are going to be tough sledding here for a while. That, you know, people are burnt out. People are tired of being remote. They want that human contact.
Well, yeah, so you can break it down. I mean, in listening to some of your past conversations, you know, we're going to arrive at a hybrid. You know, if the chief financial officers have anything to say about it, you know, the average sales overhead attached to a good field rep is $10,000, $14,000. A lot of that is real estate and travel. And, you know, to your point, there's been enough success selling remotely that they're not giving all that money back. So it's going to wind up somewhere between the way it used to be and a fully virtual model. But I think, you know, as we're 6 months into it, some of the things we're learning is Zoom fatigue is a scientific reality. I was just on the phone, you know, with the folks at Oculus, you know, and a bunch of the folks I work with on the faculty of Wharton. And this whole notion of AI, EQ-based AI related to emotional quotient is going to become a more important field. And moving to three dimensions and haptics and even, you know, maintaining eye contact and whiteboards. I'm feeling and hearing all these things that I want to move out of the Zoom checkerboard or matrix into something that feels a little bit more fulfilling in terms of collaboration, engagement, and eye contact. And I think, you know, we're 6 months in, we're moving down the maturity curve. So I think some type of a hybrid is going to emerge. And those are some of the underlying factors that I think are going to be on the minds of the folks who are doing sales enablement, which I think is your focus.
Yeah, I mean, certainly that's part of it. Yeah. But we speak more broadly about sales in general. And so you'd written this article in Forbes, which I saw and reached out to you and said, hey, let's talk about it, called The New Economics of Field Sales. So I think definitions are important. So how are we defining field sales for the purposes of the analysis that you're doing?
You know, that's a really good question, because really there is no such thing as field sales anymore.
That's right. That's why I was asking the question. Well, I mean, yeah, there are a few companies that have it, but the numbers diminished substantially.
Exactly. And so, you know, you and I look at this discipline. I think you're 40 years in, I'm 35 years in. I was party to, you know, the transformation in the 90s, where folks like IBM and Geico took, you know, simpler transactions and put them into a call center. And I'm a real, you know, I think a lot of the innovation has come out of direct marketing. I think that's one of the reasons why RingDNA is really so relevant right now, is their gene pool is coming from the right place. And so I think if you look at it now, you know, omni-channel, you pick the buzzword. I think even, you know, a field sales rep is working out of their home. They've been working remotely for a long time. The systems they use look and smell a lot like what was running a call center in the 90s. So I think, you know, it is obviously a hybrid job. I think the things that distinguish field sales are obviously maybe experiential, collaborative, big ticket items, you know, face-to-face engagement, you know, complex buying units, relationship building. Some of those things have to be done face-to-face, you know, including these whiteboard working sessions where we're configuring and designing, you know, process equipment. And I'm hearing a lot of this from industrial folks. So, you know, field sales in my mind was always a highly skilled, big ticket, collaborative type of thing. But again, I view this in terms of shades of gray, and I've got something called a channel design compass that the academics like, which is you can design any system you want just by modulating coverage, control, customer experience, and cost. So, you know, ultimately, you're absolutely right. And I don't think there's any one selling system that doesn't have four or five parts. You're seeing specialization in terms of product specialists, inside sales folks, industry specialists. Think about what's going on in account-based marketing and selling. You know, the roles are fragmenting and segmenting, which is a good thing. The trick is the teamwork and the cohesion, making it all make sense for Soak. So, you know, you're going to get a lot of long-winded answers from me today because there is no black and white anymore.
Well, and that's, I think that's one of the points. It's one thing I started reacting to in your article is you know, you'd written at one point about, you know, business leaders and I'm looking at a way to transform sales approaches, you know, while retaining the cost savings they get from remote selling. And sort of implied in there is that, oh, well, we woke up, you know, in the midst of this pandemic and transitioned to work from anywhere. And wow, we're saving all this money on real estate and travel. And my first reaction to that is, well, okay, if this was such a good idea, why did it take a pandemic for companies to see the light? I mean, the technology has existed for years to be able to support this way of selling. So it's not like Zoom is new or any of this other stuff. So why did it take that?
I think you've asked the most important question. And again, given the fact that you guys, you and I are almost historians here, I was the first.
You keep dating me.
I was the first sales tech, MarTech analyst at Gartner Group. We're talking 97, 98.
Yeah, well, CEB, right, yeah.
Yeah. And I'm like, I wrote a book on how sales and marketing is technology is changing sales and marketing in 2001, and they still haven't done half the stuff in the book. Right. So I think you make a really, really good point, which is, you know, this is more about change management than it is about the technology. You and I know the technology has been there for decades. It works. It's worked. You know, one of the folks on my team, Jeff McKittrick, you know, ran sales enablement at Cisco. You know, they've had WebEx for decades. I think you got the operational thing. It's about leadership, change management, teamwork, incentives, and basically economics. So if you look at what happened in the 90s, IBM.com, they had 9,000 blue suitors. Remember, that was the best sales rep in the world was an IBM-trained blue suit sales rep.
Yep.
They had something they affectionately called an eight-wheel sales call. Eight sales engineers, two cars, probably $3,000 a meeting. But they were selling mainframes at 90% margins at million-dollar transaction prices. It worked. When their average transaction size slipped to like $35,000, servers and things like that in the 90s, you know, Lou Gerstner came in and said, hey, you know, I can't sell a $35,000 server in a $2,000 sales call. And you open up the call center. You play it forward over the next 6 years, 10 reorganizations. They took their blue suit field sales force, and that may have been the prototypical field sales force, down from 9,000 to 3,000. Mm-hmm. And they built what they called a 12,000 person teleweb. Teleweb channel. You know, IBM.com. They fused it. They used the channel. And I think what happened there was a transaction economic model. You know, a guy like Lou Gerstner said, well, wait a second. An eight-wheel sales call costs me $3,000 a transaction, and I got to probably have many of them. And I can't sell a PC that way. Meanwhile, a call center transaction is $35. And oh, by the way, the customer experience is actually better because all the blue suitors were selling to the proverbial veto. They ignored the guys in the cubicles who are actually buying the stuff. And so you had a transaction of $35, a better customer experience, better cross-sell. And then we started offloading transactions to the web at, Lord knows, you know, $1.
Sure.
And so that economic model took that to the board. That was the most seismic shift in selling model I've ever seen. And it was all driven by the economics. So this chief financial officer is a huge player in this equation. You know, they think marketing is complete BS. And sales, you know, market development funds, really, you know, come on, market development funds, that's booze and travel and things like that. And finally, they so that's, you know, if you add up market development funds, travel, events, and the real estate associated with these folks, that's 10 grand. Boom, that disappeared overnight. And guess what? By and large, the machine kept running. And they're like, well, wait a second, you know, why did I need this in the first place? Why can't you be virtual? And you and I know that there are some things missing, and that's not the model, but boy, you know, they're like, whoa.
Sure.
Never waste a crisis, you know, and I think, you know, this is a transformational thing. I had the head of sales who I respect at US Bank said, we've had more transformation in the last 5 weeks than in the last 5 years. And I think a crisis in that regard is a good thing. And everything you and I believe should have been happening, you know, 5, 10 years ago, you know, across the sales enablement spectrum, it's finally happening. And even things like VR and AR, which again, we've been playing video games for a decade. Why aren't we selling, you know, aircraft engines and tractors in video games? All that stuff is actually on the table right now. So sure. You got me a little excited there, Andy.
Well, no, but I think that's good. I'm glad I did. But I still think there's sort of a fundamental issue which needs to be addressed, which is that, yeah, CFOs and sales leaders get excited. You know, you sort of referred to this in your article about, you know, they're looking for ways to sell more for less. And so they've embraced this idea that virtual selling is the way to do it. But first of all, I think there's a problem trying to solve two problems at once, which is selling more and selling for less. But we have the primary issue in sales right now across the board is people just aren't, our productivity and performance is dropping in B2B sales. I mean, if you look at the data points that we have.
By 20%. My numbers, we did a big study, a 20% drop with the adoption of remote selling. So it's not perfect. It's sure. 0% of the cost and 80% of the productivity. But yeah, well, we have hard numbers. I agree.
80% of the performance, right. So, So, I mean, I don't think we can solve two problems at once. But it seems like for me, and I get the sense from your article, because, you know, that you're obviously talking to a lot of the CFOs and so on in your work, but is, yeah, we want to harvest savings from sales. But on the other hand, sales is performing like crap. So why aren't we reinvesting that money into helping sales sell more? And the technology itself doesn't sell. So we still have this human issue in sales, is how do we make our human sellers better?
You zeroed in on it. You know, let's look at the basic facts. You can't cut your way to growth. And everybody knows that. They'll take as much as they can. But I think what's really interesting here is if you look at what we invest in our salespeople, the things that can create the productivity you're talking about and value are training and technology. And yes, by and large, the return on technology assets is painfully low. Most of these stacks are running on one or two cylinders. But that said, if I had to look at the portfolio of investment, real estate, travel, things like that, training and tech, even though we're paying, you know, $100 a seat for Salesforce or Gong, it's still a fraction of the budget. And in my view, if I look at that portfolio, you could double training and double tech. And I think you know from experience, there's a good chance. That's where the leverage is. That's where the leverage and productivity is going to come from. Building more sales offices, traveling more, I don't know. Some, yes. But I'm looking at that portfolio saying, where is the real engine of productivity and innovation? It's in training and tech. And I could double those budgets and still come out with lower cost to sell. So, you know, you can have your cake and eat it too to some degree. But the big thing is people have to believe that training and technology are really going to drive that transformation. And again, if you look at, you know, what RingDNA does, a lot of the sales enablement technologies, they work. And any sales apps guy or gal knows what to do. It's a board level issue. Management has to commit to being data driven. Management has to commit to, you know, building out a tech stack that makes sales more effective and the skills. And that's what really beggars my mind. You know, and I know people have a lot of flexibility now to reconfigure real estate portfolios, create hoteling and hybrid version. Mm. But for me, I think, and I'd love to hear your perspective on it, is I believe that investment in technology and training and development, and obviously integrating those together, is a much better bet. I think the track record and accountability of what we're getting, you know, the return on data, the return on technology, return on content, and I know you and I are both, you know, content is the engine that makes sales run right now, is phenomenally low. So we're kind of shooting ourselves in our own foot. It shouldn't be. But even with the current returns, I think a bet in training and technology, double that and reinvesting into that, at least doubling that, should improve coverage, control, speed, visibility and engagement. I mean, I think the math works even in a, you know, even in a bogey scenario. I think the math works.
Well, but here's let's dive into that. So let's take training, for instance, because this has been one of my big bugaboos is, you know, we have all this data that's, you know, CSO insights and you referred to data. And so we've got these data points to say B2B sales performance is dropping. This is predates the pandemic by years. So I think it's 7 or 8 years in a row that CSO Insights has reported this dropping. And at the same time, we're spending $20 billion a year in sales training in the United States. And so you can make the argument that, well, I mean, this is not necessarily a correlation, but we're investing $20 billion and we're getting less performance out of our sellers. And during the same time, we're investing billions in the sales technology, and we're also seeing a drop in sales performance. So what's that telling us, right? It's clear at some point is, A, the training is misdirected and ineffective in a substantive way, and technologies are great, but we still don't know how to use them in a way to generate a return. Because, again, if you look at productivity gains throughout our economy and the returns based on innovation technology, and Paul Krugman wrote about this several months ago in the New York Times, it's basically flattened since the year 2000. You know, we had this steep growth in productivity driven by technology in the 80s and 90s, and then productivity growth has sort of flattened to like 1.25% a year or something like that, despite all this new technology coming into the space. And it's like, well, what's going on here? And you sort of look at it and you say, well, the real drivers in productivity improvement and sales, assuming sales tracks the economy and sort of large, were email and broadband. And since then, we haven't really taken advantage of the technology that's come into the space to improve productivity.
You have gotten to the core issue, and I've wrestled with this Gordian knot for decades, and I've got a very strong point of view. One, we're fighting the battle at the wrong altitude. For good and bad reasons, the tech stack is a fragmented, you know, it's fragmented, siloed, functional silos. It's a bunch of parts. It's like if you had an engine on the ground and their carburetor and the cylinders were all spread out on your garage floor. And the fundamental issue where value is being created, and that's why categories like revenue acceleration and what you guys are doing at Ring is really resonating. It's all about connecting the dots. Everybody, you know, if you look at the research, most enterprises have 20 solutions that cover coaching, development, playbooks, the pieces, now sales AI and things like that. And I think the short answer to your question is executives have to take a top-down look at the portfolio, just like your stocks, just like your engine, and really examine how they work together. And if you want to, and our big thesis, and the reason we play this game at the board level, is that this is about connecting the dots. We have a picture. There's only five ways to create value: better management insights, affecting the four P's, you know, price, promotion, packaging, personalization, sales resource allocation, putting the right resources in the right place, lots of leverage there, making the channels perform better, like what you do with automation and assists, and making the team perform better. There's only, you know, at 20,000 feet, there's only five ways to create value. And you've got this whole stack. And when I look at a piece of technology, you know, sales AI, content optimization, and LMS, it's three steps to value. I could have intent data on the left. I could be pulling something out of conversational intelligence in your solution. But if that information doesn't get processed and moved to somebody who can do something about it, and that's at least a three-step process in a modern sales stack. And so the big answer to your question is the game has changed to creating federated ecosystems that connect the dots to solve the same six fundamental sales problems. So I'll break down the training problem. If you think about the training stack, everyone's got at the bottom layer, you got an LMS, Now you've got these, you know, coaching programs, the recording programs, all sorts of great innovation, MindTickle, Allego, guys doing great things out there. In the middle, you've got the digital asset management guys, the sales playbook they're supposed to be training on, the repository, the measurements, the recommendations. And at the top, we're taking this conversational intelligence and this 30-fold increase in engagement data. And we're starting to say, who's doing what? Who's applying these lessons in sales calls? How is this working? What are the skill gaps? And then finally, a feedback loop down to training, learning in the moment, reinforcement, which is such a big thing. Mm-hmm. I outlined 12 different solutions that should be a closed loop process. I train, I run the play, I see how the play worked, I go back and reinforce and get better. That's a pretty simple process. And there's no reason on earth that those shouldn't be connected. Why a sales manager can't see, I know Bob took the training, and I can see from conversational intelligence that he actually applied the training. Mm-hmm. And there's some places he did it wrong, and I'm going to go back and fix those things. He has all the tools to do that. Nobody in the organization, and I'm not talking about a czar or something like that, but you know, sales ops folks know what to do, but they're just not looking at the whole portfolio. So, you know, Jeff McKittrick on our team, at Hitachi Vantara, he took a look at that. He connected those dots, and he barely got out of first gear, and he won Cirrus Decisions Sales Enablement Executive of the Year. And he almost laughs. He goes, "It was so simple. I was just connecting the carburetor to the spark plug to the exhaust, you know, to the cylinder."
Sure.
And we're barely even, you know, the types of things that your solution could do, and what you call revenue acceleration, that's high maturity stuff. We think we're driving a Formula One race car. In fact, you know, I would argue your solution is a Formula One race car, but in reality, the guy running the race are firing on one or two cylinders. The guy who's going to win the race is going to fire on three cylinders. So we got to stair step our way into this. So I'll back off and say, you asked a hard question. And I think when you're really gaming out, it's about connecting the dots, that not new technology. Most of the technology is there. But it's about connecting the dots. The only caveat would be, I think this analytics revolution is going to be the glue that makes it easy for us to connect the dots. And I think that's what's really going on in the revenue acceleration category, or you name it. We don't have a vocabulary to even describe this. So I'll pause, but I think you've asked a really good question, and I think that's the one single answer, connect the dots.
Well, to me, it seems like there's a dot that isn't often thought of and isn't connected, which to me has the potential to drive substantive improvements in sales performance. And some people call it effectiveness, but I call it sales productivity. So for me, and I've been doing this for decades and in the way I've managed companies and so on, is sales teams, is that, you know, productivity is a rate of output per unit of input, right? And for me, if you really want to define what productivity is, we should be looking at, okay, well, how much revenue can a seller produce for an hour of sales time? And that is the fundamental unit that we should be trying to improve. Yeah, instead, we talk about, you know, let's add more sales time. It's like, well, no, that's not moving the needle. In fact, I've had this conversation with several people that have been around for a while, like myself and you and so on. And my belief is that, you know, that measure of productivity, even with all the technology we've brought into the space, is no higher today than it was 30, 40 years ago.
You're absolutely right. And again, you are zeroed in on a fundamental issue. We're dealing with flawed metrics. And when you unpack the metric conundrum, I in the 90s, I just flipped SG&A. And I can't, you know, the cost to sell metric. Mm-hmm. For every dollar of sales and marketing and tech, you're getting, you know, Dell was getting $8, IBM was getting $4. That picture made it to the boardroom. And unpacking that picture is powerful, but that doesn't get at it. And sales productivity, I've built these models. It's a flawed metric. And guys like Steve Lucas, who really is an impressive fellow, he doubled Marketo and profitability in a year. you know, and folks who really run big sales organizations at the top say the metrics are flawed. But let me tell you what's wrong with the productivity metric, because I fought this battle, and this is maybe why I don't have hair and you still do. two problems. You got the nibble to death by ducks problem, and you got the golf course problem.
All right,
and the nibble to death by ducks problem is this. When you look at, you know, the 80-20 rule, in any business, you can find 80% in the factory, 80% of your problems are 20%. We know that. But not in sales. If you look at the latest Salesforce time utilization data, salespeople have a bunch of 9% problems. Planning is 9% of their time. Coaching is 9% of their time. Finding content is 9% of their time. You know, presentation development is 90% of their time. 9% of their time. So it's like you're going after a bunch of 9%ers, and those break down into a lot of little things. And so finding the easy button is hard. And then you got the golf course problem, which is, hey, guess what? I just did free up half your time. Are they spending it on the golf course, or are they spending it? Are they spending it actually selling more? And we've kind of solved that problem, you know, with conversational intelligence and, you know, the maddening pace of virtual selling now. But still, you know, but still, it's a really difficult metric. We wrote an article with a bunch of sales and marketing leaders, and they're saying we should be doing something different. We should be taking this engagement data. And when I talk about this engagement data, there's a revolution of engagement data. Email data, content data, you know, where content goes, the calendar data and the conversational intelligence data and the first party data that we're pulling out of these systems, we have a 30-fold increase in data about what salespeople are doing every day, every minute, in every minute of a sales call. That just wasn't there 5 years ago.
Sure.
And there's a revolution. And so what are you going to do with this data? Are you going to spy on people? No. What the smart people are saying is, think about Nadia Comaneci, you know, gymnastics or ice skating. You tell me what a 10 looks like in terms of three things: sales effectiveness, pipeline health, account health, and aggregate those metrics. For example, a healthy account has a lot of engagement, a lot of stakeholders involved, a lot of response, good meetings. They keep their meetings. They share the content. They're engaged regularly. You could almost build an EKG. Any customer success person could build an EKG of what a healthy account looks like. We have that data. We should be rating. What Steve Lucas says is, define a 10. If an account falls below a 9, ring the alarm bells. Same thing with a sales rep. Think about that. I can see how they're spending their time, you know, between customers, all these different things. And we're not spying on them, but there's a healthy mix of activity that suggests they're executing probably. Define what a productive rep is. And again, I'm agnostic as whether that's a customer success person or whatever.
But here's the issue. And this is the reason I think why productivity is so important is it's almost immaterial to some degree how productive someone is today. I'm more concerned about the rate of improvement.
And so,
because I'm not sure objectively how we measure productivity, if we're talking other than the fact that I can collect data, and I was doing this back in the 90s with teams I ran, I knew exactly how many hours it took of selling time and sales engineer time and so on to produce a dollar of revenue. And so, you know, when people talk about, as you've referred to as before, is, you know, we've got this accelerated pace of selling. It's like, okay, yeah, was looking at a deal not that long ago, deal review, and people are talking, oh, close this, you know, wonderful target account. And I looked at the number of sales hours involved in making it happen, and the first thing that popped in my head is, well, this is not scalable. So by just de facto, that was unproductive effort in order to capture this big deal. If we don't learn from the experience to say, because it wasn't right now, you know, people focus on, you know, I always challenge sales leaders and CEOs, and this is, you know, they talk about their sales cycle. I say, well, but the sales cycle is a meaningless statistic or metric.
Absolutely.
Because what's meaningful is how many hours you had to invest to bring that deal from initial point of interest to close. And that could take place over a month or it could take place over 6 months. But if you add those hours together, then you start being able to say, okay, now I can start mapping out what theoretical performance we should be able to achieve. Because if I know an hour of selling time is actually going to generate this much revenue, then I can put together a model that says, yeah, this is our path to growth, because this is how we're going to prove the productivity of the individual. But we have no focus on that. And I think, you know, we can apply all the technology in the world we want, but if we don't have a common definition in sales of what productivity means, then we're still going to be fighting this battle 20 years from now.
I think you're asking a very complicated question, and we can get into it a lot. I think one is the metrics of defining, and it's bespoke to every organization. You know, what, you know, teamwork, what is it that you need to be doing to, you know, build lifetime value for the customer? So let's break down the three fundamentals underlying some of your important points. Mm-hmm. One is you can't coach output. You can only coach activity. So, you know, it's easy to say, you know, hit this number every month, but you can only coach the activities. The good news is,
well, I think you coach behaviors.
Behaviors and activities. That's what I meant. But if you thought about it, a ride along used to be a really expensive thing. You know, you check in on your folks, you'd hear how the meeting went. You wouldn't hear it firsthand like you can today.
Sure.
And then you go along for ride alongs and you give them some guidance. So this revolution of data is giving sales managers full transparency down to the minute and the word in sales calls. Second, you've got a couple of things, evaluation. We have a way to evaluate. This is where you screwed up in the sales meeting. This is where the client's face went, you know, arms crossed. This is where you went off script, or this is what worked. So automated evaluation is great, and also prioritization. You know, why are you chasing this lead? Why are you choosing to spend your time here versus here? So I think when you break it down, the potential is there to use this information to make people better. I think you made an important point, which is, you know, onboarding and ramping and making people better. Measuring productivity is one thing, but you're saying, how are we going to make it better? So obviously it's a coaching problem. It's an incentive problem. But I would argue that the granularity in which I can go in and specifically point, a lot of the folks, smart folks are saying teaching happens in the moment, you know, not post facto, you know, Sure. How did the meeting go? And so what gets me excited, and I think we have to acknowledge all the flaws you pointed out, is managers do have tools and leverage that let them isolate the places. This lead wasn't going to close. You shouldn't have followed up on it. I've heard people tell me that when they quartile RFPs and reject the bottom quartile, productivity goes through the roof. It's hard. You tell me, you know, a lead is an asset. It's an insurance policy. It makes me go to sleep at night. The last thing I want to do is turn away a lead. But that's actually the driver of productivity.
Sure.
You can be rational about those types of things. So I'm super excited about the potential.
But a lot of this gets done compensation incentives. I mean, there are managers who are incentivized by the size of their pipeline.
Well, I would agree.
And pipeline coverage ratios, which is, you know, a perverse incentive. And yeah, it gets back to compensation again for individual sellers, is back to this notion of productivity. I mean, think how much more effective it would be if instead of saying, look, we're going to pay you commission, which is basically, you know, piecework. We're paying you on piecework, like a factory worker.
That's a crude metric, and I think you got it. And SQLs and MQLs are flawed. I haven't met a progressive executive who thinks that that's got to be abandoned.
Right.
The unit of production is just wrong in a fast world.
Right, but if you looked at productivity in the way that I talked about it and said, look, I got a measure for you. I know that when you're engaged in sales, This is the amount of, you know, amount of revenue you're generating per, let's say, hour of selling time. Your incentive is going to be based on improving that number, that unit of how much dollars of revenue you generate per hour of selling time. Now, suddenly, somebody has an incentive to seek out training, if not get more serious about the training they're provided, but seek out the type of training that will help them become more effective. If coaches were, you know, geared more towards that type of focus, I think would transform, have the opportunity, let's say, to transform sales if we just align incentives to the place we want them to go. But we're so stuck in the past.
You're stuck in the past. Change management and inertia. I even see myself falling into it. And I think what Steve Lucas says with his customer engagement metrics, and the reason I think this battle has to be fought at the top is you've got to get someone at the top of the organization to craft. I mean, think about it. You're providing them a paint set and a palette that they just didn't have 5 years ago to craft beautiful compensation schemes that reflect real customer value and lifetime value. For example, the service folks need to be emphasized. They're always de-emphasized, and the frontline guys who are creating digital signals of buying or attrition need to be motivated and incentive to throw that over to the right person. So, the metrics are crude and asymmetrical. I would argue that most of the value is being created in the back end of the process, cross-sell, retention, and a SaaS model. And I think digital marketing is saying, hey, there are signals. Yeah, I know some of these digital marketing people are ridiculous. But at the end of the day, they're sitting upon signals and data that can make the whole engine run. And they need to be motivated by the same to do the right thing. So I think this is almost like an impressionist painting. And it's got to come from the top. And it's possible. It's technically possible. That's what bothers me. But someone at the top has to say, I'm abandoning MQL. Robin Matlock has a great video where she's just rants about this. And she works at Dell, VMware. And she is, I think, at the vanguard of creating measurement schemes that are really reflective of how value is created on an activity level, regardless of whether you're sales, marketing, service, or account management. And I think, that's where it's got to go. That's a huge change management problem. I don't want to sound like I'm Pollyanna, but when you're, and remember, Steve Lucas was a CEO. He wasn't head of sales, and he had to make it happen.
Well, but I think you're absolutely right, though. And let's take a step back. I mean, let's look at, you talked about coaching, let's say. This is an activity that everybody acknowledges is perhaps the thing that more than anything moves the needle in individual sales performance. We now have all this technology, recorded calls, conversational intelligence, conversational AI, as we have at RingDNA, that provide great tools to be able to facilitate that. And yet it's not happening at the level that it should. And partly because managers are also saying, well, gosh, I'm being distracted by all these other things I need to be able to do, report to my bosses, yada, yada, yada. And so I give an example. I said, well, okay, fine. Sales is a performance-based profession, just like sports. So if you look at a professional sports team, they have a roster of specialized coaches, right? And I spare the audience my analogy with soccer because I give it all the time. But
you're talking to I'm Italian, so you can talk soccer all day long.
Okay. But the point being is that you look at the coaching staff of a professional sports organization, and they've got these specialized coaches whose job is very finite. And so, I advocate that maybe sales managers shouldn't be coaches. Why don't we hire coaches, professional coaches, into sales organizations? But you'll get the pushback from the CFO saying, well, what's the payback on that? Well, the payback's maybe 2 years down the road. But we have to fundamentally restructure, and we may have more costs now. But if the impact is we generate substantially more profit through increased sales, then it's going to be more than worth it. But what I see is a repeated pattern over decades of top leaders refusing to invest, even consider investing, and radically restructuring sales to become more productive. And so we're just repeating the same mistakes we've done for decades.
I'm in the business of affecting change, as you are. These are very difficult problems, Andy. And I think I want to go back to the very beginning of this conversation. My daughter's taking a history class, and I take a skeptic's view of history. I say, whenever you look at a history event, think about the money. Follow the money trail. The founding fathers were in debt to England for millions of dollars. They were highly motivated to secede from the Union. So let's go back to what I say. Economics drives everything. And the CFO matters not because they're draconian and they're just dying to cut these discretionary budgets, but they have to see the economic business. I'm fascinated by professional football and soccer because the economics are such that you can have 10 coaches. I think he nailed it. It's an economic proposition, which is winning that game or playing a little bit better means a lot of money. It also means a lot of money to sales organizations, but that's not a generally accepted truth. The prevailing wisdom is a lot of sales and marketing funds are vanity. They're afraid to cut them. They're soft. And one of my six big trends is this notion towards attribution. I'm a member of MASB, the Marketing Accountability Standards Board. I'm a big leader in connecting sales and marketing to share price. Because in fact, when we go to the board level, if you cannot connect a sales enablement system, a data investment, a training investment to share price, you're not going to affect the train. So at the end, it changes. So at the end of the day, I think one of the things you're saying about sports is that there's no general acknowledgement in the business world that there's economic value in training. And I think that's the rub of it. And somebody has to wake up and realize that the same level of coaching on an offensive line or for a soccer midfielder is relevant to a salesperson. Change isn't going to happen. So I'm really all about making the change happen. Even though, you know, as you point out, these are very nuanced, persistent, and difficult problems. I'm just trying to find a way to move. And I think this crisis and the fact that folks are real, if they realize in the first half of the equation, which is I can sell virtually pretty effectively, 20% less, but they have to realize the second part of the equation, that every dollar I pump into training, development, and technology that makes that happen is the best investment I could be making. There is no conventional wisdom on that front. And I think that gets to the core of the frustration that you and I have.
Right.
And not you and I. It's a speaking for anybody who runs
we're speaking as advocates, yeah. All right. Well, Stephen, thank you very much. This has been great. We'll have to make sure we do this again. So if people want to find out more about the Revenue Enablement Institute, what should they do?
Well, the Revenue Enablement Institute is what I view as some of the smartest people in the world from academia, practitioners, and experts. You know, you belong in the club, coming together to find ways to solve these problems. If I do my job right, I'm the stupidest guy in the company, and so far I am. where you can reach us at revenueenablement.com. As I mentioned, and have you figured out, Andy, I'm a nerd. I fight battles with data. And the reason I need that data is I'm trying to convince boards, CEOs, and CFOs of the things that you and your constituents in sales ops understand. And so you can reach us at revenueenablement.com. We've done a lot of this research is available there. And in particular, we're focused on three federations. The one we're talking about today, which I think you might be interested in, is integrated learning and development. We've built a blueprint for how you connect those dots. Another one is the digital selling platform. And the third is data-driven selling. And all this is like a chutes and ladder game or checkerboard on how you connect the dots to double coverage, control, customer experience, visibility, and engagement.
All right.
So that's our mission, connect the dots. I believe you know what you folks are doing at ReamDNA is a big part of that. And probably it's the reason why it's so hard to describe the value you create. You know, people get it in their belly, but I think a checkerboard is a much better way to explain how you make all the pieces work together. So I appreciate the time. Love to come back again.
Yeah, well, as I said, we'll make sure we have it. Make it happen. So, all right, Stephen, thank you.
Thanks so much.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. I'm so grateful for your support of the show. And I want to thank Stephen DiOrio for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you could also leave us a rating or a review and let us know how we're doing, well, we'd certainly appreciate that. You can do all that on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this episode is over. So thank you for your help. And thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales. We're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.